Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis. It's the 10th of April 2014, and today's interview is with Nauro Campos, Professor of Economics and Finance at Brunel University. We discuss Professor Campos's recent research that uses data from the various EU enlargements since the 1970s that shows the benefits that both rich and relatively poor countries have derived from becoming members of the European Union. Campos estimates the gain in per capita GDP to be approximately 12%. I began the interview by asking Nauro to explain the motivation behind the research.
Well, I think that there are two main reasons to look at this issue. I mean, one theoretical reason and one is an empirical reason. The theoretical reason comes from the political economy literature, which is a very vibrant literature and has looked at this issue, at the relationship between political and economic integration. And there are two strands that deliver rather different implications. I mean, there is the strand by Alesina, Spolaori, and Vatiarg, which probably the best known paper is the American Economic Review in 2000, who has a very telling title, which is Economic Integration and Political Disintegration. That tells you everything you need to know. I mean, the main implication of that very interesting strand of the literature is that political and economic integration are substitutes. The other strand of the literature is Philippe Martin and Meyer and Tönig, and also papers by Bro and Ruta, who have also theoretical models that generate opposite predictions. And I think that the Bro and Ruta paper in the Journal of the European Economic Association a couple of years ago has a very telling title, which is Economic Integration, Political Integration, or Both. You see, then you have vibrant theoretical literature delivering contrasting implications. And of course, looking at the European experiment should help throw light into these two different explanations. And that's the theoretical motivation. The empirical motivation is, well, it's a very important question, for which the empirical evidence is disappointingly thin. I mean, the question we are looking at is essentially, are the countries that joined the European integration project better off? Are there monetary benefits from joining the European Union? And you can break down that question empirically, right, in its three main components. Then you have the direct cost of EU membership, which, I mean, we know, I mean, it's in the books, essentially. There's not much you can do about it. You have the indirect costs, which the feature there is we'll never agree about what are the indirect costs, right? I mean, how much does the EU regulations cost these economies? I think there are estimates, but it's impossible to agree, and I don't think we'll ever agree about those costs. And then there are the benefits, for which you can try to estimate, but right now there are very, very, very few estimates. They are not only few, but they are widespread. They cover a very wide range of values, and then they go from 2% to 20%, and the way you read those values are going to be in levels. There are some studies show that if European integration didn't happen, if certain countries have not joined the European Union when they did, income per person, income per capita would be 2% lower today, while at the other extreme, you have some studies saying that income per capita would be 20% lower today. And what is distinguished about this literature is the fact that there's an issue about robustness of these results. I mean, there's a lot of improvements that we can make. And my favorite example is one of these estimates was published in the European Economic Review. And in the abstract of that article, it finishes the abstract by saying, well, you know, the estimates we present in these papers are not completely robust, which is something that already tells you a lot about the state of play.
So you were looking at the benefits of actual entry to the EU, not the benefits of trade liberalisation or the euro or the single market. You were looking at the broad kind of concept of the benefits of entry to the European Union.
Exactly, yeah. That is a very good question because this is an important caveat. There is a very large literature examining each one of those events. It's a very rich literature, and excellent studies. But of course, I mean, you have literature looking at the effects of customs union in the 1960s, of the single market in the 1980s, and of course of the common currency in the 1990s. But I mean, you know, the question that is really interesting or really, really powerful is, okay, what about the overall benefits of membership, the aggregate, really aggregate, if you can say that, benefits from membership? And addressing that particular question, the literature is small, and the results tend not to be robust, and they tend to be quite widespread, and that provides a motivation for our research.
Good. So the particular methodology used, the approach to gathering the data and analyzing the data, was particularly novel, I think. Perhaps you could describe that for us in a little more detail.
Sure. I mean, this is a method that has been pioneered by Alberto Abadi and co-authors. The seminal paper was published in the American Economic Review in 2003. And the method has a long name. It's the synthetic control method for causal inference in comparative case studies. But it's usually goes by synthetic counterfactuals, okay, or synthetic control method.
Or SCM.
Or SCM, exactly. And this is a method that econometricians have been paying a lot of attention because it's a very interesting method. Then, for example, Imbes and Woodridge have this beautiful review in the Journal of Economic Literature on recent advances on the econometrics of program evaluation, and they have a whole session on this method. Then it's not something that is coming out of the blue or something. People fully aware of it. The distinguished characteristic of the method is this estimation of an artificial control group, a synthetic counterfactual. And then what the method does is essentially try to minimize the pretreatment, in our case, EU membership, which is a 1-0, the pretreatment distance, which is kind of essentially the mean square error of the pretreatment outcomes, between the vector of treated countries' characteristics and the potential synthetic country characteristics. And this way of describing the problem already suggests to you that there are essentially three key stages or three key elements in the implementation of this method. The first one, you have to know when and what kind of treatment you're looking at. Then in our case, it's going to be EU membership. Then, Ireland, in 1975 was a full-fledged member of the European Union, and in 1972 is not, right? Then we know this type of treatment when it happened. You have to specify the set of matching covariates. Then, what you think drives the outcome of interest. In our case, we are looking at per capita income in levels and labor productivity. Then we have a very, very parsimonious specification, which essentially has capital labor, quality of labor, and the structure of the economy, share of manufacturing, for example. And the third thing you have to specify is what is technically called the donor pool, which is the set of countries from which the algorithm will pick up the countries that will make up the synthetic counterfactual.
Yeah, so these group of countries which had not joined, which weren't part of an integrated union of any
That's
kind.
Correct. We tried to generate as conservative a set of estimates as possible. Then it's absolutely possible to use, for example, to calculate the synthetic counterfactual for Ireland, for example, that started in 1970, entered in 1973. We could well use Portugal or Austria or even Slovakia. But, we do, for consistency, we used exactly the same pool of countries. Then we use, in the results we report, we subject the results of various sensitivity analyses. Then we have results using the whole world or just neighbors, or the Mediterranean basin. But for the results, our preferred set, we're looking at a group of high middle-income countries. Okay. And that's where the algorithm picks up the countries for the donor pool.
And you looked initially at two particular times in the European Union's history of two enlargements, one in the 80s and the second in 2004.
Correct. We look at all four major enlargements, yeah. 1973, 1995, the 1980s, and 2004. But we thought that in order to think about and better interpret the results, it's useful to group these results in some way. That's what we end up doing. The 1973 and the 1995 enlargements, we call them rich country enlargements. And we have a measure of that because we can measure the gap at entry, the difference between average incomes of the current members vis-a-vis those the incoming members, right? And for both 73 and 1995, they're quite high, right? You're talking, 95, 96% for 73 and slightly above 100% for 1995, which is the Scandinavian and the Scandinavian enlargement of 1995. And for the other two enlargements, we call them poorer countries enlargements, and they cover the 1986, which is Spain and Portugal, and 1981, which is Greece, and we call that the southern enlargement. In the 2004, which is the Eastern Enlargement, which is Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Latvia, Lithuania, etc. Right? Then what we do, we divide the results in this kind of poorer and richer countries enlargements. Right? By doing that, it generates a number of interesting questions. If you look, for example, at the rich countries enlargements, I mean, we do find that, I mean, for all countries, in this particular case being the UK, Ireland, Denmark, Austria, Finland, and Sweden, I mean, we do observe positive returns to EU membership in every single case, both in terms of per capita incomes and labor productivity. There's no exception.
So there's no particular advantage for poor countries. You're saying it's everyone benefits, actually.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Everyone benefits, but it's not the per capita income that seems to be the crucial element in determining whether or not a country benefits from EU membership. What our results suggest, actually, by comparing 1995 with 1973, I mean, it's a quite an interesting comparison because these are all rich countries. But, I mean, this is a speculation now. I mean, what we find when we estimate the returns is that the payoffs for 73 are much bigger than the payoffs for 1995. Indeed, the payoffs for Ireland, UK, and Denmark are comparable to the returns to Portugal and Spain and Poland. And that got us thinking, I mean, why can that be? Right? What are the possible explanations for that discrepancy, right? I mean, because I think we also expected that income will play a big role in these benefits, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And our explanation was, at this point is a conjecture, and we are working on that now, of course, but I mean, we think that one possible explanation is institutions, right? I mean, the institutional gap between the average recent entrant and the incumbents was very big in 73, and it's very small for 1995. And that kind of, it's a possible explanation. There's a lot of talk, especially from the transition literature, on how the EU and the debate today with the Ukraine, for example, how the EU, if indeed one of the main benefits from joining the European Union is in terms of institutional improvements, if our interpretation of the results is correct, I mean, it confirms that view. That is for the rich countries enlargement.
And the poor countries?
The poor countries, we also have a very interesting set of results. And it's interesting for a different reason. The poor countries, you have Spain, Portugal, and Greece in the 1980s, and you have all the former communist countries in 2004. And there are a number of interesting features of the results. I mean, the first one is that I think it's quite surprising that the level of benefits is comparable. Then Poland in the first 10 years of Latvia or Lithuania or the Czech Republic in the first 10 years of EU membership has benefited as much from membership as Spain or Portugal. Then it's quite a sizable number. Then this, I think, is quite surprising. The other thing it's quite interesting is that of all the countries you look at, and again, I mean, these estimations are all done independently. I mean, the method is a synthetic case studies. They are done one by one. And for all countries, we find that joining the European Union is positive, is a positive effect, except for Greece. And what the results show is essentially that if Greece had not joined the European Union when it did in 1981, per capita income of Greece and labor productivity in Greece would be higher today. And that is, I think, is a quite interesting an interesting result and raises similar questions in terms of institutions.
That's not going to bring much comfort to the people in Greece at the moment, is it?
Well, I think it the results are very interesting because what they show is that the gap between Greece and the synthetic Greece and the actual Greece, then between the Greece that did not join the European Union in 1981 and the Greece that did join the European Union in 1991, it increases all the way to 1995, and then it starts to decrease. You see, and that I think is where the interesting aspect comes in.
Yes.
I mean, the reason, I mean, the Greek economy started to catch up, if you want, relatively well understood, but I think that the institutional dimensions of it have not been fully appreciated. Because, I mean, the usual explanation, I mean, why is that happening? Well, 2004 Olympic Games, infrastructure driven by shipping and tourism. But one of the additional explanations that has an important institutional element to it is the role of the financial sector. And the financial sector in Greece after 1995 is one of the very few sectors that has actually, I mean, in comparative terms, I'm not saying that, you know, in global terms, there was a lot of reform, financial liberalization in Greece, but in comparative terms, looking at other sectors in the Greek economy, the financial sector has experienced considerable reform. And then you have institutional change in one of the sectors that are usually believed to have helped to close this gap. Then you have institutions playing a role on both sides of the, you know, it doesn't matter. That's what I said at the beginning. Yeah, income per capita, you know, at first sight may be very important, but if you start to look more carefully at these results and try to understand them, you realize that they have a quite income per capita plays a quite secondary role.
Yeah. So the implication is not then that Greece would effectively be better off if it left the European Union now. That's not what is being suggested, is
no,
it?
No, definitely not. No. Definitely not. I mean, you say it very clearly in the paper. Definitely not.
You also talk about in the paper a very interesting effect, which you refer to as the anticipation effect. Could you give us a little more detail about that?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, as we talked about earlier, one of the important decisions in this, the application of this methodology, is to determine when and what treatment you're looking at and when it happened. And we know that membership has changed over time. I mean, the meaning of membership has changed over time. I mean, when the UK came in, when Greece came in, I mean, the level of requirements and there were negotiations, but they were much simpler than, for example, when Estonia came in. That is one reason why anticipation effects must play a role, because economic agents, I mean, once it's announced, early 90s, that the Czech Republic will be a member of the European Union, then investors start to act as if. I mean, that then they start to act as if that will happen.
Yeah.
And then you can see that anticipation effect is quite interesting because you see them in the 2004 enlargement and for Austria. Now, if you know anything about transition, I mean, that really rings a bell, because Austria, Finland, and Sweden, to this day, they're not NATO members. Then the reason, one of the reasons that political scientists use to explain why they haven't joined the European Union is the Cold War. It's an entirely political reason. That's another explanation why the returns are so low. I mean, they are highly developed, highly integrated, and the only reason they are not joining is because of the Cold War. But as soon as the wall comes down, the Berlin Wall comes down, Austria immediately applies to membership. And it's quite interesting because you see that in our results. I mean, the benefits, the gap between the synthetic Austria and the actual Austria start to diverge. I mean, we use the official date of accession, which is 1995. But in the case of Austria, the divergence starts in 1989, which is the year in which Austria applied to membership. And what we do, I mean, because only Austria, in the 1995 enlargement, you do observe that story, the importance of anticipation effects. But for the 2004 enlargement, for all eight countries, you have much stronger anticipation effects. And what we do in the paper is essentially we reestimate all the 2004 countries using an earlier date. And again, just trying to be conservative and trying to give a motivation, a reason for that particular date. I mean, we can use different dates for different countries, because the method allows you to do that. But we decided to try to be conservative and pick 1998 as the date for the Russian crisis. And then we reestimate all the benefits for 2004 countries and find values that are a bit higher them using 2004, of course, because I mean now you're capturing, you know, a longer post-treatment period, and the gap, the size of the gap has not changed much, and make them quite comparable to Spain and Portugal, not Greece, but because it's negative, and in the UK and Denmark and.
So it's fascinating research and amazing results.
Yeah.
It's so simple, it's untrue almost. But I wonder if, Nauro, you might just be able to very briefly summarize for us the conclusions and where you think that's indicating in terms of the sort of policy messages or what we should be taking from this research in terms of this European experiment.
Yeah, well, I think that this is a method that values the heterogeneity. But because we have such a large number of countries that have a very similar level of benefits, we can calculate an average and we can give you a takeaway number. And in our case, the takeaway number is 12. I mean, what on average for the first 10 years after your accession, the average country, incomes per capita in that average country, had it not joined the European Union when it did, would be 12% lower on average in the first 10 years. And that, I think, is a number that is well above any measure of direct costs you find. Just to give you an idea, it's the case of UK, for example, you're talking half a percentage point of GDP compared to 12%. It's much sizable. And we think it also above any reasonable, agreeable measure of indirect costs one can come up with. Then, I mean, this is a back of the envelope type of calculation, but what the results seem to suggest is that it has been very, very successful in raising per capita incomes in Europe. And it's a project that we should treat with great care, discuss very, very seriously, and recognize that it's a process that has changed already a lot with the crisis. Take a few years for us to realize how much it has changed, but it has changed a lot already. And it would be very, very wise to have a discussion that is very serious, based on numbers that maybe are too good to be true, but are totally transparent, totally replicable. We hope that this starts better dialogue about a very, very important decision we're going to have to make in the near future.
Nauro Campos, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.